It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. As a college student, what was your financial approach to financial planning? Did you even have one? April is Financial Literacy Month, and in the final installment of our series, we focus on The Missing Semester, a financial planning book written by local investment manager Gene Natale Jr., Senior Vice President at C.S. McKee. He and University of Pittsburgh Katz School of Business professor Jay Sukitz recently held a student roundtable on financial literacy where college and high school students from around the region shared their financial planning stories. Today, we'll use some of those students' comments as a springboard for discussion with Professor Sukitz and Gene Natale. Gene Natale joins me in Studio A. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Paul, thank you. A pleasure to be here.
And we have Jay Sukitz by phone. Jay, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Paul, how are you? Hello, Gene. How are you doing?
Jay, I'm well. Good to be speaking with you again.
If you have a comment or question for our guests, call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm, and you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. What financial lessons would you like to share based on mistakes you made as a college student? What do you wish you would have learned earlier? What would you like to learn now? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Gene Natale, what is the meaning of the title of your book, The Missing Semester?
Pretty much as it sounds, this is a class that is not taught, broadly speaking, in many of our nation's high schools and colleges, despite what we're finding is a high level of enthusiasm by students at both those levels.
And if this book was written, say, 30 years ago, how many people have come to you and said, boy, I wish I'd have seen something like this a lot sooner?
Oh, boy, everyone who reads it. You know, we as a nation do a great job of producing doctors, teachers, engineers, mechanics, but we don't prepare them for what to do with that first paycheck.
So why was it important for you to write this book? Why you and not somebody else?
Matt and I had been saving articles on the subject, reading, saying, can you believe this is happening? Can you believe that people keep digging these financial holes? And as you talk to people, you find out that in many of those cases, the mistakes are well-intended. They're accidents. And then, wow, all of a sudden you're in a hole. You're in a big debt. And it's really hard to dig out.
Is this something that a lot of students, a lot of young people, 18, 19 years old, getting out of high school, going living on their own for the first time, that they simply either don't pay attention to or just don't have an interest in?
I would actually say they have a high level of interest once they get awareness, and awareness being the key word. You know, you never know how much we don't know until you learn more. Then you realize how limited our knowledge is on a subject, and I think this applies in this case. Students, young folks, want to make good decisions about money. They want to have a financial head start, and when they see the benefits of doing so, for instance, when I talk at high schools and colleges, the number one question that the students ask is, where do I start a Roth IRA and how? They see the opportunity to starting young. So sometimes you have to see the path at the end versus some of the more painful short-term steps.
And we'll get into the Roth IRA and look at why that is the preferred way of saving money for the future. Professor Sukitz, with regard to young people, why is it that young people are simply not paying attention, not interested, whatever the reason is, to their financial future?
I'm not sure. I tend to agree with what Gene said. I don't think that it's a matter of lack of interest. I think it really boils down to kind of waking up to the fact that there are things that you don't know about. And that when your interest becomes sparked, then you really start thinking about it. And I'll give you an example. We spend a great deal of time at the University of Pittsburgh, and of course other universities do this as well, teaching people like business students or economics students an awful lot about theory and about how to crunch a lot of numbers and how to apply those things to what I would call third-party decisions. Like, for example, decisions you might make in a corporation or decisions you might make in a bank. And yet we don't spend almost any time at all telling those students about the theory and the concepts behind how to manage their own money. And, of course, oftentimes these students are coming out and they are having worked part-time and building up a lot of student loans, now have a great deal of financial responsibility with the fact that they now have a job where they're making a real solid salary, and yet they don't know where to start in terms of saving, paying down their student loans, developing a personal financial plan for themselves, just as an example. I mean, one of the things I've done, and I've done this as a trial run now over three different semesters, is to have students actually make a personal financial plan for themselves with horizons of 1 year, 3 years, and 5 years. Where would they like to be in 1 year? Where would they like to be in 3 years? Where would they like to be in 5 years? Much of it based, by the way, on reading the book, The Missing Semester, using that as an augmentation to other things in the finance courses that I'm teaching.
Now, short of reading the book, what you're outlining for students sounds like a solid plan, but how do you go about building a financial timeline in a year or 3 years or 5 years? What are you saying that they need to do?
Well, what students really need to do, and actually this is not only applicable to students, this could be applicable to anyone saying, hey, I want to get my financial life together. And that is to develop a plan that's very definitive and very specific for about a year. For example, if you're graduating and let's say you're starting at XYZ Corporation and you're going to make $50,000 a year, what you probably want to think about is how do I want to start paying down my student loans right away within the next year? What is my goal to start and where do I want to be on my student loans a year from now, 3 years from now, and 5 years from now? Part of that goal might also be, how do I want to max out on my 401k program with my new corporation right now, starting right now and in this next year? Because sometimes, for example, you cannot immediately begin to contribute to a 401k. You might have to wait. So what I tell students to do is make up some goals for yourself that are very specific and definitive in 1 year. Specific but a little less definitive leaves you a little room for maneuvering in 3 years, and then a more general goal of where you want to be 5 years from now. For example, our students coming out of a undergraduate business program, their five-year goal might be, hey, I want to be in an MBA program 5 years from now. So my general goal is to be in an MBA program, but my more specific goal is I want to get rid of all of my student debt before I'm in that program.
Yeah, that would be, I can imagine a lot of people listening to that idea thinking that would be great if I didn't have that. One of your students, Professor Suketz, said this was one of his takeaways after reading The Missing Semester. Let's listen.
It's not that we don't want to know about financial literacy. We don't know where to go. And I think this book has been a great start because when I was in high school, I thought I was invincible. I'm sure that goes for all of us. Student loan debt isn't real to us. Credit cards, the ramifications of that, they're not real to us. We just think that our parents will take care of it. And I think that as parents, there has to be some sort of incentive to save for a later period. So I think it has to be instilled at a young age.
So what is the typical scenario that goes on today with parents packing off their students to go off to college? Are they being handed, in order to get into debt, you have to have some money to spend in the first place. So are they being handed a credit card and simply just not knowing how to behave with it?
I'm not sure that they're just being handed a credit card. Many students that we have here at the University of Pittsburgh, and I'm sure this is true at other universities, are out there working all the time. I mean, we have some students that have like two or three part-time jobs. So some of them don't even have credit cards. I think it's really not a question of handing them something and then having them not know what to do with it. I think it's really a question, and I actually bring this up with students all the time. I bring up the question that one of the most dangerous things in your life is not knowing what you don't know. And I think this not only goes for students, but it goes for the general population in general, that when you operate in a certain sphere, you're sort of in your own little world. You know, I got to make some money because I have to eat lunch tomorrow, and I got to and I'm taking out loans because I have to pay for tuition. You kind of forget about the bigger picture. And I think oftentimes what people do, and that student, who I happen to know him very well, that student I think was talking about the fact also that sometimes we just don't plan for the future. We just assume the future is going to take care of itself somehow. And what, of course, tends to happen is the future has this way of sneaking up on you if you haven't planned for it. And I think that's what he was really kind of talking about. And the other thing, of course, is all of a sudden, and this is very true, I think, with business students, with engineering students, and others, all of a sudden they go from being this poor student to now they have a paycheck maybe coming in of, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 a month, and they don't know what to do with it. And the tendency, I know a couple of students on that panel mentioned the tendency might be to, you know, go out and buy a BMW or something. So that's why it's so important to understand the parameters in which you're operating in.
We're talking with University of Pittsburgh Katz School of Business professor Jay Sukits. That's the voice you just heard. And also with us in studio is Gene Natale. He is the author of the book, co-author of the book, The Missing Semester. He's also senior vice president at CS McKee. Gene, how early should students start saving for college?
So the 3 weeks ago, the book won the 2013 Book of the Year for Excellence in Financial Literacy, and a gentleman, the keynote speaker, told a story where a 13-year-old was in the front row, and he was given all this financial advice, and at the end of the presentation, the 13-year-old walked up and said, "Boy, I wish I'd have started when I was 10. So I guess there's no early that's too, it's, no age is too early. And to answer the question that you asked, Jay, where does it start? Why not the home? Why not with the family? Why not around the dinner table? I was at a high school in mid-March, and a young man raised his hand. They had read the book in the spring semester versus the fall semester, and he had said, "You know, I really screwed up. In the fall, I made the decision to go to a college that my family, frankly, can't afford. My parents told me we couldn't afford it. I was stubborn. I stuck to my guns, and they let me accept." He said, "I feel terrible about that now." So have the conversations at home, understand the ramifications of the decisions. Our choices do have consequences.
Our number is 412-246-2002 if you want to join the conversation, if you have questions or a story to share. And speaking of some important stories, when students were asked at your roundtable for examples of good and bad financial advice, Gene and Jay, good and bad examples of financial advice that they've received. Here are some of their responses.
I think the best financial advice I received was from my parents, and this was a few years ago as a high school senior trying to decide where I was going to attend college. And I really had my heart set on a small private university in Pennsylvania, actually Lehigh University, but it was very expensive. And while my parents did save for me to attend college and were going to help with the burden, they made it very clear to me that I was going to come out with significantly more student loan debt if I chose to attend Lehigh. And as an 18-year-old, that's a very hard decision to make, I think. But luckily, my parents sat me down and explained the implications of graduating with a lot of debt. Probably the worst advice I received was actually pertaining to credit cards. There is a common misconception that you should let the balance carry over from month to month. And I've noticed this mostly amongst college women, that they think it's appropriate to have like four credit cards open at a time. I've had roommates that have done that, and I've actually given them financial advice that it's probably not the best idea.
My parents figured the easiest way to pay off credit card debt is just opening up another credit card to pay off that debt. And my mother told me when I was reading this book, do not do what I did. They have been in so much debt, and the fact that my mom told me that they both earn enough money yearly to pay for my college and not have to struggle, but because of the immense amount of credit card debt that we have, it's going to be hard. And my mom actually told me that they got married 20 years ago and they just kind of paid off for their weddings.
So, Jean Natale, Jay Suk, it's for parents who don't know how to talk about money or don't know much about money themselves. And you heard a pretty good example of there of that there just now. What are some resources or approaches that you found to be accessible for high school and college-aged students?
I'll just regress real quick. Jay, what a group that was. That's going to be a really tough student panel to top in future years.
Yeah, they were excellent. They were excellent.
To answer the question, Paul, I guess an approach I always like to kind of stick by is be open and honest. Then you don't have to remember what you said. Learn from past mistakes. And maybe recognition that we have more control than we might think. I think it's very important that parents, that mentors deliver that message to students, to young folks, because Jay had mentioned two things that were important. He said first, as his job as a professor, is to spark the interest of his students because they don't necessarily know where to start. A great way to spark interest is to give examples of how these students have control and how they can take ownership.
Jay, we received a response on Twitter to the question, what was your approach to financial planning in college? Blue Archer writes, pay yourself first. It's the key to saving. Pay yourself first. It's the key to saving. What does that mean?
What does that mean to me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that what that means is, I mean, the way I take that is, prioritize your spending. And what you should think about first should be how you're going to use your resources for yourself. And I actually, you know, you can use a lot of different examples of that. And I actually talk about students. I talk to students about this all the time. You can frivolously spend your money on all sorts of things. You know, you can go out and go to every sort of sporting event, and you can blow your money on buying whatever you want to buy at stores, clothing. What you're doing, though, is making the mistake. You are spending money on yourself, but you're not spending money on things that are important to yourself. Just as an example, one of the things that I've told students in kind of a, this is sort of an adjunct to the book, The Missing Semester, is that when I went to work for the first time, I thought about, and I went to work in a really terrible economic times. You might remember what the mid to late 70s were like, in very high double-digit unemployment, double-digit inflation. And I always thought about the fact that I needed a buffer just in case my company merged or I lost my job or whatever. And so what I thought was most important was to put away an account, basically, that I could write checks on, that had 6 months of my expenses. And so that's what I would think about. When I think about pay yourself first, I would say save up money for yourself first. Give yourself some security so you can sleep at night for no other reason other than the fact that it gives you some security. And by the way, I would just like to add one thing to what Gene was talking about a little earlier concerning parents. And you know, one of the things that I would say to parents is do some research. You know, do some research, put some pen to paper, write down some numbers, figure out what makes sense. I think there's way, way too many decisions made by young people, especially, on things like where they want to go to college, maybe based on how they like the campus, or, you know, perhaps peer pressure. When in fact there might be all kinds of better ways and more economical ways to get a really super education, rather than thinking about it from a more visceral basis, like, gee, my friend's going there, so I have to go there. That's probably not the best way to make a decision. Much better to do some research.
Gene, what seems to click with students? Does it help to use cautionary tales or to promote the positives about saving for the future?
The cautionary tales maybe scare students more. I think seeing the rewards, seeing the opportunities is what excites any of us, frankly. When you see if you start saving at the age of 18 versus 22 versus 32, the benefits are massive to starting earlier.
A number of students, like the first girl in the clip, mentioned that they didn't go to their ideal college for financial reasons. What do you suggest students do to be sure that they don't have to compromise with their ideal college?
Like Jay just said, talk about it with your parents, and not just – and this was actually a question, Jay, at the panel, a gentleman from the audience had asked, is there peer pressure? And the students unanimously said, absolutely there's peer pressure. There's peer pressure. If my friend's going here, I feel pressure to go here as well. If my friend's going out to this event and it costs X dollars, I feel pressure to spend those X dollars also. And it's hard to say ignore peer pressure, but at least prepare yourself by understanding the financial consequences, looking at a college that costs 10, 20, 30. Look at the different breakdowns and see what you can fit, what fits your particular budget.
So if you get a young person to at least analyze why, you know, the visceral aspects of the decisions, is that part of how you help a young person understand the difference between a want and a need?
Absolutely. If you say, well, so how much do you like college XYZ that costs $50,000 a year and versus college ABC that costs $15,000 to $20,000? And then you show them, if you choose a $20,000 college and you're able to start saving at the age of 24, 25 versus 34, 35, and show them that dollar difference that 10 years compounding does, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars in many cases. That opens eyes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Then I was going to say, so then you really have to think, well, how much do I like that campus? How much does that peer pressure my friends are given? I'm going to have to weigh this a little more seriously.
Just forcing them to just look at something differently and maybe take some of the emotion out of it and just sit down and make more of a rational decision.
Absolutely. I'm 33 years old. My wife and I sit down with so many friends our age, and Jay, you probably see this every day too, who are in debt up to their ears. Debt up to their ears. And it's a very scary feeling, and it's a hard path to get out of when you don't start saving earlier.
I want to refer to what one student mentioned, and that was the idea of trying to knock out prerequisites before college to reduce her costs. And she's now eligible to enter college as a sophomore based on all of her credits. Quite a few kids do this, certainly ones that have the foresight to plan ahead and maybe map out how to handle costs better. What about, though, the demands of college that most sophomores are ready for because they went through freshman year, the socialization, the demands of juggling coursework in a college setting rather than a high school setting? Is it a good idea, even if it makes financial sense, for everybody to knock out as many prerequisite credits as they can before they go into college so they're spending less time and therefore less money at that college or university?
Jay, I'm going to throw that question to you, but first just going to put a little bit of context to the listeners. The panel that Paul and Jay and I keep referencing was comprised of 12 students from 5 different schools, and we intentionally picked the schools. They first all incorporated the missing semester into the curriculum, but secondly, we wanted a broad range of opinions. So we had 2 high schools, Fox Chapel Area High School and Greater Johnstown High School, 1 community college, Butler County Community College, then both the University of Pittsburgh and Duquesne University. Boy, was that a big win. It provided a wide range of opinions. I will, with that background, Jay, I'll throw the specific question to you.
Yeah, the thought about, going into college and thinking about it, at least as I consider it, and I've talked to students about it, oftentimes boils down to things like, is this going to be a prestigious university for me to go to? Or is that a cool place to go? Those are very often the kind of forces that operate on students when they're making those decisions. And yet I think it's very hard to generalize, to say, well, this is good for one student, so it should be good for everyone. I have seen students come into the University of Pittsburgh with tremendous numbers of advanced placement credits. But they start here, even though they're far ahead in academics, they still really start from a socialization standpoint as a freshman. And so you develop that. It may allow you to finish maybe a semester or two early. That could be good. The other thing we see, and I honestly think this is one of the smartest things that students can do, but it's not very popular sometimes, and that is to really be economical and do something like go to a community college for 2 years. Just as an example, if a student goes to CCAC, just as an example, for 2 years, and they do well, they get good grades, we sort of have an automatic acceptance of those students. They can come right into the University of Pittsburgh. Now, usually they get a little bit of a surprise because the rigor here in terms of academics tends to be a little greater. But what they've done is they've saved a lot of money for their first 2 years. They haven't spent near as much money as they would have. And
So then the question, Jay, is are the students, is that trade-off worth it, worth what they're missing by skipping those first few months, or not skipping them, but by bypassing being on a campus to save money?
Well, yeah, that's what I was getting to. What you find is, again, it's an individual thing. Some of those students come and they fit right into the campus. We had a student a couple of years ago that took that exact path, and he wound up graduating as our top finance student, and he was president of the finance club, and now he's gone on to a tremendous job with PNC. So it just depends, that's really what I was getting to. The plan that parents arrange with their children, I think, has to be tailored to an individual person, but you've got to do a lot of research about it. For someone just to say that I want to go to XYZ school and I want to study archaeology or something like that is probably a mistake. It's probably much more important to do a lot of research. And you and I, Paul, you and I had this conversation a few weeks ago.
Right.
You really have to think about what you're going to major in as well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I know we had the conversation about following one's passion, but you also have to consider the practicality of it also. You know, it's one thing to follow your passion. It's another thing to still be paying off your student loans, you know, when you're in your 50s, and that happens to people.
Let's go to the phones. We have Ryan at IUP, Indiana University of Pennsylvania, with a comment. Ryan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
It's funny that you just mentioned archaeology. I have a four-year degree in archaeology, and I was having trouble paying off my student loans and cost of living based on sort of the entry-level positions that a four-year archaeological degree gets you. And so I went back to school here at IUP for a master's degree. And you guys have talked a lot about how students leaving college are getting these jobs where they're making $40,000, $50,000 a year, and sort of focusing on how individuals who are actively in the workforce are planning their financial careers. But my question is, for me, I'm leaving a master's program and there really is not that much work available. When I thought a master's degree and an increase in my student loans would, you know, pay off for each other. So for us students who are leaving programs with a lot of student debt and we can't find jobs, how can we financially plan to pay off our student loans or to save money when we can't even find those jobs?
Ryan, was your master's in archaeology also?
Yes, it is. I'm graduating in 3 weeks.
And I'm curious, just to throw a question out at you, how many years between undergraduate and then when you started that master's degree?
I took a year and a half, and I was out in the workforce and saw that to get those supervisory positions, I needed a master's degree to sort of move up within the cultural resource management field.
I can answer the question a couple ways. One, the average, us as individuals, we stay in our first career for 4.4 years before actually switching careers. But to answer your specific question, and what I've found in the business community, I work in finance and investment management, is that once you get your foot in the door, the world really opens up. So you may find it challenging to, A, get your dream job right out of that master's program, but don't let that discourage you from accepting any job that gets you in either the company you're looking to get in or the specific industry you're looking to get in. And maybe for a year, 3 years, short term, supplement that entry-level position with a second job. I worked three jobs out of college for 4 years. Anywhere. It's just to get that little bit of income, but maybe pick something you enjoy. If you're an outdoors guy, find a store at Dick's Sporting Goods where you get a good discount.
Thank you very much for the call, Ryan. We appreciate it. We're just about out of time. I promised that we would circle back to the Roth IRA. When it comes to saving, a lot of financial advice books stress the importance of Roth IRAs. What's so significant about this type of IRA?
I would say to everyone listening right now, go do your homework. Google Roth IRA, learn about it, particularly for the younger audience, but really anyone. The Roth IRA, in my opinion, takes uncertainty out of the equation. Every dollar you put into a Roth IRA account is yours when you pull it out versus your traditional 401k in which your capital gains are taxed at your current tax rate. The flip side is that comes from after-tax or pre-tax dollars with your paycheck, hence why the 401k is so popular. There's a great deal of analysis out there showing how powerful Roth IRA is for young folks. Jay, I don't know if you'd add anything to that.
Well, I mean, one thing I would add, I really believe in using your own sort of self-directed investing. And so I would say, yes, open an IRA, a Roth IRA, as soon as you can. I even suggest to students that if they have a little money, while they are students, they should be opening up an IRA. But what I would add to that is, and this is so important, 401k plans, which you pretty much find now at virtually every company, we've gotten far away, in private enterprise especially, and a lot of nonprofits, we've gotten far away from the old defined benefit plan, the pension plan. And so what we now have are these defined contribution plans, 401ks and 403bs. One of the things that people do not do, and they absolutely should do, is max out on their 401ks and 403b plans, because invariably there is some kind of company match. Maybe it's 50 cents on every dollar you put in, or maybe it's a dollar for every dollar you put in. But if you don't max out on the amount of money you put into those plans vis-a-vis the contributions that the companies make, you're literally leaving free money on the table.
That's great advice, and certainly something that we've heard people being encouraged to do. We have to call it here, gentlemen, but I want to thank you for taking part in this final installment of our month-long series on financial literacy. The book is The Missing Semester, a financial planning book written by local investment manager Gene Natale Jr., Senior Vice President at C.S. McKee. He and University of Pittsburgh Katz School of Business Professor Jay Sukitz recently held a student roundtable on financial literacy. And Jay Sukitz, as always, from the Katz School of Business, thank you for joining us, as well as Gene Natale with us here in Studio A. Gentlemen, appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul. My pleasure.
Coming up, our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, looks at the NFL draft and the league's policies against discrimination based on sexual orientation on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.